universal expansions and Brahma and all of that. I'm not very adept at explaining all of that anyway, so I can barely remember who I am and where I'm going, so I better remember something about Srila Prabhupada as much as possible. what you particularly wanted to hear about, I mean, I could talk about Prabhupada forever, but you wanted to hear about Moscow, the mosque. You've all heard this story about Moscow, how Prabhupada went to Moscow? Okay. This was a long time ago, about 1970, 71. That's 35 years back, 35 years ago. In those days, the world was a very different place. There were two basic superpowers, America and Russia, the Russian Empire, the American European Empire, strongly divided by philosophy, strongly divided by territory, strongly divided by what was called the Iron Curtain. It was impenetrable. And both sides lived in the daily fear that the other side would drop the atomic bomb or the hydrogen bomb on them and destroy their civilization. So there was a constant race for better weapons. There was the constant fear of annihilation. There was a tremendous tension around the planet that went on since the Second World War, probably 25, 30 years of this heavy tension all over the planet between Russia and America. At this time, it was impossible. No one had ever gone to behind the Iron Curtain. It was impossible to go there as a Westerner. Only spies by some covert moves would slip behind the Iron Curtain to spy on the Russians, or they would slip into America and spy on us. And the favorite books in the bookstores were spy novels, spy books about Russian spies versus American spies. You have to remember, this was the dominating state of mind all over the planet since we were small children. So then, after Srila Prabhupada came into our midst and preached widely all over America and the West and Europe, even he had started his movement here in Bombay and in other parts of India around 1970. He had been saying for the previous 3 or 4 years, he had been saying, "Someone try to get me into Russia. I want to speak behind the Iron Curtain." But the devotees in those days, we were not very adept at doing things. We were all young men. We didn't know how to do these things, like arrange for visas and this and that. Besides that, everyone kind of thought, no, it's not possible to go behind the Iron Curtain. I mean, we were fearful that if Prabhupada went there, that perhaps he might be harmed in some way, because all we heard were stories that any foreigner found in behind the Iron Curtain will be thrown into jail his whole life or tortured. These were stories coming out, propaganda that we heard. So no one took it very seriously to get Prabhupada arrange anything in Russia for Srila Prabhupada to go there. Somehow or other, I think there was one devotee named Krishnadas in Germany. Somehow or other, he had formed a correspondence with a Professor Katovsky, who was a Orientalist of some sort. He was a professor of philosophy, I believe, in the Russian Academy for the Oriental Studies, or something like that. He had a very vague knowledge of Bhagavad Gita and Hindu culture. Well, of course, in those days also, India was very much aligned with Russia. I guess of the two superpowers, it was kind of a strange situation, but India was more dependent upon Russia and the Iron Curtain countries for its weapons and for its material growth. The Western camp was supporting Pakistan. So this was a very unsettled situation, very strongly divided lines between the two cultures. And Prabhupada's desire to go behind the Iron Curtain and preach was never taken very seriously by the devotees, even though repeatedly he said that. If you can help me at all, try to get me behind the Iron Curtain. Try to get me to Russia. Why would he? I mean, he was always bold, and he always took the greatest risk. But this was beyond risk. To go to Russia in those days was almost like if you were to say, oh, let's go to Baghdad right now. I mean, it's a very dangerous situation. You don't want to see your spiritual master in Baghdad in the war. So like that, we thought, it's too dangerous. It's not important. There's a lot of other things going on. Parts of the world we have not yet had Krishna consciousness expansion. So this was about the situation in 1971 when we were here in Bombay. And at that time, I was the president of the Bombay Temple, and we had a building on Warden Road, Akashganga building. You might have seen it. I think we were seventh floor, sixth floor, something like that. Beautiful place. And many devotees living there. We asked Prabhupada to come, and he came. He was staying there. And one day, Hansa Duda came from an American devotee from Germany. He had opened some very nice centers in Germany. He came down to visit Prabhupada, and Prabhupada asked him if he had yet obtained any visa for him to go behind the Iron Curtain, because that was supposed to be Hansa Duda's job, to try for that. And Hansa Duda said, no, I haven't been able to do this or that. So he looked at me and he said, Shamsundar, can you get me visa for Russia? And I said, I don't know, Prabhupada, I'll try. So that was that. That afternoon I went down to the Russian consulate here in Bombay, a Russian embassy, and I took the passport of Srila Prabhupada, his servant, his two servants, his secretary and his cook, I mean his personal valet, his personal servant. And they told me at the embassy here, they saw some dhoti and shaved head and all. And these were largely Indian people, Indian citizens working in the embassy. So they kind of liked the Hare Krishnas. And they said, yes, we can get you this visa, but you have to go as a tourist, and you're only limited to 5 days. And you pay a single amount, and that covers your transportation, your food, your hotel, and your sightseeing. And you have to have an invitation to come. Someone has to write you a letter inviting you to come and sponsor you while you are there. So I went back to Prabhupada with this information, and he said, oh, very nice, he said. Then I will go, and you will go. He looked at me and says, you will go with me. He said, can you type? And I said, yes, I can type. Then you will be my secretary. Just like that. So we sent a telegram to this Professor Kotovsky. This is the professor of Oriental Studies in Moscow, who had been corresponding with Krishnadas. And we... Prabhupada worded it. Prabhupada managed personally almost everything we did in those days, right down to the tiniest detail. You know, like in, even in cooking, he would say, add two parts water to one part oil, blah, blah, blah. He instructed us in every detail of everything we did, just like a father training his children. So he said, he worded the telegram. It said, Dear Professor Katosky, I am coming to Moscow, giving the dates. Please arrange some speaking engagements and cable back to me. So the next day, a return cable came saying something about, yes, I will be happy to see you when you come to Russia. So I took that and the letters, previous letters he had been writing, and our passports down to the Russian embassy, and they gave us visas. It was impossible for American citizens to go to Russia. Impossible. And yet they gave a visa for two American boys, myself and the Prabhupada's servant, Aravinda Das. Aravinda Das. I think they thought we were Indian citizens because we were dressed like this. I don't know why they gave visa. It was impossible to get a visa. And I came back to Akashganga with the passports and visas and laid them on Prabhupada's desk. And I saw that smile come over his face. He was so happy. At last, he could go behind the Iron Curtain. This was a very major thing for Prabhupada. He wanted to do it for years. So I said, Prabhupada, we got the visas, but the thing is, we have to leave tomorrow. Just like that. He said, all right, let us pack. So we left, we got on the plane, we went, I think it was Air India, had a flight from Bombay to Moscow. And what we had no plan what to do there, only this one professor's address in Moscow, try to find him and get some program started, something. We only had 5 days. So on the way there, it turns out that the pilot of the 747 Boeing, he knew Prabhupada. He had seen him and talked with him somewhere here in Bombay after a program. He had met him or something. So he came back and he invited Prabhupada to come and sit with him in the front of the 747 while they were flying. But he wouldn't allow us, only Prabhupada. So after half an hour or so, then Prabhupada came back to his seat and he had this look on his face of just pure pleasure and joy. And he sat down beside me and said, I have flown the 747. He quite often, Hari Suri and I were talking yesterday about Prabhupada, and one of the things we were talking a lot about was sometimes how Prabhupada would experience and relish just a moment. He would stand and just observe something very small, like an ant crawling across the wall. He would stand and watch the wall, the ant crawling for some time, just observing quietly. Sometimes a long period of time, just observe something and then absorb it. If someone else was there, he might make some comment. Otherwise, he would just look. So when he got in situations that were new for him, like flying 40,000 feet above the earth in the front of a 747, imagine all the controls, thousands of buttons and dials. He would just look at everything, just study everything. Then look out the window for a long period of time and just watch the clouds go by. And you could tell in his mind he was thinking about Krishna, how wonderful Krishna is, and how he's created all this material energy with just a small bit of his total energy. And it would be a new experience, something else. Then he would usually take that observation and then work it into his preaching somehow, into the next day's lecture or that day's lecture, or sometimes into his translations. If you go through these purports in his books, quite often you see some examples or something, and he quite often those come from the day he translated that passage or the day before, some event or something he observed. He would think about it and put into his translations as he was going. Anyway, the plane finally landed in Moscow, and one of the prohibitions in those days, you were not to bring any printed matter to Russia. Nothing, not one magazine, book, anything. So when I packed my bag, I left out all of our transcendental literature. In those days, we didn't have much. We had only Bhagavad Gita and a couple of other small books. But I left those out of my luggage because I thought, everyone told me, if they catch you with this scripture, they'll throw you in jail for the rest of your life. But Malati, my wife at the time, she, unbeknownst to me, had snuck in this copy of Bhagavad Gita in my suitcase with many photos of Prabhupada and Krishna and so on inside the book, just stuck inside the book loosely like this. So we got to the customs, and it was a long table, and they were looking at everything. I was the last in the line. Prabhupada and the others went first. And they looked at everything. They looked at every thing we were in our baggage that we were bringing. And they came to my suitcase, and first thing he reached under, he pulled his book out. And I thought, uh-oh, that's it. I'm off to prison. And as he pulled it up, all of the photographs fell out on the ground and went all over the area. And the man was so embarrassed, big KGB man with one of those hats, he looks like a soldier, and all these ribbons and his uniform. He was so flustered, so embarrassed, that he ran around trying to pick everything up, and his other friends were picking everything up. And he threw them back in the suitcase, along with the Bhagavad Gita, and just said, psh, psh, go. He lost some face, as they say. Next. So off we went, and we rode into Moscow in a big government car. Everything was government. Government, communism means government. Big government car, sitting comfortably in the back seat and watching the streets as we drove toward the center. And Prabhupada made some comments about what a big change it was from the West, because there's no opulence, visible opulence at all. Everything was stark and drab and black and white. There was no even though it was June, this was June, so it's the height of the growing season in Russia, the summer. There was some green, but not much. There was very little beauty to the city of Moscow. As we got closer into the city, he began to see some churches. And in front of these churches, there were guards stationed. And I said to him, Prabhupada, they've closed the churches. No one is allowed to go in, only a few old people. It was astounding for him to see that. They've closed the churches. They have made the pronouncement that God is dead. That religion is the opiate of the masses. That means it deadens our brains by artificial means, this religion. And it prevents us from seeing the real philosophy of life, which is communism. So we get to the hotel, we make the arrangements, we tell them that we are vegetarians and that we must cook our own food. So they gave us some rooms. My room was on another floor, Prabhupada's room was down on another part of the hotel, huge hotel. And they allowed us to use the servants' kitchen, you know, the cleaning people's. The maids, they allowed us to use their kitchen to do the cooking, to do our cooking. Aurobindo was going to cook. Prabhupada was so smart, he foresaw all of this. He brought his three-piece cooking set. Does anyone know about that, that three-piece cooking set? It's three pots in one. And a tiffin. He brought a tiffin also in his luggage. So we had our own way of cooking these things. But the problem was food. Where to find food? So that was my job, to find the food. Aurobindo's job was to cook the food. And plus, I had to try to find Professor Katovsky. And keep I was new, but I knew that Prabhupada got bored very quickly, and that it would be my job to keep him constantly engaged in spreading Krishna consciousness, even in this foreign place, which I had never seen. So I had to totally surrender to Krishna, that Krishna, please help your servant Srila Prabhupada by arranging something, because I can't do anything. My first job was to get food. I think Prabhupada might have taken a little rest, and I ran out. I went to a bank and cashed some dollars and got some rubles and began trying to look for food. Well, I finally, after asking a number of people, I finally found the food market. And it was actually separated into two or three units, like dairy products, vegetables here, bread over there, and each one had a long queue. Some of those queues were half a kilometer long. And each person who came to the front of the queue, their allocation might be one loaf of bread or one cabbage, one bottle of milk. So, but they would wait half the day to get that bottle of milk. And this is summer, high summer, height of the growing season. There should be food plenty. So I said, oh my God, this, my main problem is going to be just to keep the food, enough, buy enough food. But people saw that I was dressed so funny with the shaved head, they thought, must have thought I was from India. So they always let me go in the front of the line. They let me go in the front of the line. So I came back with some food to Prabhupada and told him the situation. Prabhupada absorbed the experience of being in Moscow in Russia through my eyes. He didn't go out running around like I did, but through my descriptions, he began to form his ideas about Russia. And somehow or other, I got a hold of Professor Katovsky by the telephone, and he agreed. He said, yes, come out and you meet our staff at the university. This was the second day we were in Russia, I believe. So we made arrangements with the taxi, the hotel taxi, to take us out to the university. And through these long corridors these, everything in Russia was big. I mean, the university was probably 20,000 students or something. Huge buildings and long, complex campus. But we finally found the Institute of Oriental Studies, and we finally found Professor Katovsky. And we walked in, and we right away, Professor Katovsky, he introduced Prabhupada to his colleagues, but right away we could see that he was very afraid, especially when he heard that we were Americans. I mean, he almost canceled when he saw we were Americans. But out of politeness to Prabhupada, he sat down and they talked. They began to talk. And I had a small tape recorder. Well, small in those days, the smallest tape recorder made was about this big. And they used those cassette tapes. And I had one. Someone had brought one for Prabhupada's use. So I could see they would not allow me to tape this conversation, so I hid it under my kurta and sat close to the table like this and put the microphone under the table. And I was able to capture that conversation between Prabhupada and Professor Katovsky, which has now been in a book. And then I snuck it into my bag when he was finished. But we could see after the talks that was it. Katovsky wasn't going to arrange any public meetings. He wasn't going to sponsor us for anything. He was afraid that the KGB would throw him in jail for associating with non-communists. So we left that place and went back to the hotel, and Prabhupada says, now what do we do? We have three and a half more days. So I'm in extreme anxiety how to occupy Prabhupada's time. I mean, this is a signal event, 5 days in behind the Iron Curtain. What can we do here to make the most of Krishna consciousness behind the Iron Curtain? First devotees who had ever gone there. Prabhupada always led the way. He was always the first one. So I had to go buy some more food. I had to learn all these food sources. So I went out. I went to the bank, and coming out of the bank, these two boys were standing there. One was obviously from India. One was a Russian boy. And they asked me if I wanted to change some money on the black market. If like you have black market here, not so much anymore. In the old days here, you had a very big black market. In fact, Prabhupada used to change almost all the money on black market here in Bombay. But I said, no, we were afraid. You know, they told us that whoever approaches you is probably a policeman, so don't do anything that's illegal or wrong. So I was fearful they would do something. I said, no, I'm cashing in the bank. I have my rubles. Thank you. They said, well, have you got any jeans, American jeans? They wanted to buy some jeans for me. I said, no, I don't have any Levi's. I know I don't. Do you have any Beatles records? Ah, then my mind went, aha, these guys are for real. They want to find out something about the new. In those days, the Beatles were the number one music group in the world and probably the most famous people in the world. I said, no, I don't have any Beatles records, but I'm personal friends with one of the Beatles, and I've met all of the Beatles. Oh, and then they became fascinated. They started talking. They introduced themselves. The one boy, his father was actually the Indian ambassador to Moscow. He was from Jaipur. And the other boy was Anatoly, was his name, a Russian boy who was in his final year of PhD level studies in philology, the science of languages, and the origin of languages, like that. So I said, no, I don't have any Beatles music with me, but I have my spiritual master, my Guru Maharaj, is sitting in a hotel right over there. Would you like to meet him? And the Indian boy knew what is a guru. And actually the other boy, Anatoly, did too. He had some knowledge of India and the religions of India, the Vedas, from his studies of language, Sanskrit language. So they agreed, they came with me. And as we came in the door into Prabhupada's room, and Prabhupada saw these two boys, his face just glowed. He was like, okay, this is the purpose for me coming. He was so charming and so happy. He just melted these boys' hearts. Sometimes Prabhupada paid special attention to certain people if the situation required. If they were some famous person that had to be met, or if they were some, just like your Radhanath Swami, when he was just a hippie, sadhu, walking the streets of Bombay. The first time he came in to see Srila Prabhupada, Prabhupada gave him that same special treatment, that charm, that glow that comes out. And you know that that's a special moment when you observe that between Prabhupada and whoever he's talking with. I could see that with these two Russian and this Indian boy, that this was a special occasion. Srila Prabhupada was putting on all of his charms. And he began to explain Krishna consciousness to the, to these boys and what he was doing there and all about his movement all over the world. And the Beatles had become involved. When they knew the Beatles were involved, they were already attracted very much. In fact, you can almost say that thanks to George Harrison, the communist bloc became Krishna conscious. His records were heard all over that country. And they had a so and George and the Beatles sang a lot about Indian philosophies, and in their songs, many of their songs had to do with Indian type thoughts, philosophies. So they were already inclined to like things from India, philosophies, music from India. And when they met a genuine guru from India, they were quite attracted. Especially the Russian boy. And he spoke very fluent English, which was a blessing also. So Prabhupada talked to them late into the night. It was dark. And, you know, in that time of year, it stays light until 11 o'clock and gets light again at 2, 3 in the morning. Hardly it's dark at all. But I recall that first night, it was actually dark when they left. So it must have been near midnight. The next morning, well, Prabhupada stuck to his morning routines, which was to walk, you know, and this hotel was just very close to the Kremlin, Red Square, the famous Red Square. Lenin's tomb is there. So Prabhupada would get up, we would walk early in the morning through these streets. Already the sun would be quite high, and several things he observed. There were no other people in the streets. It was empty. There was practically no traffic, none. Foot traffic or cars, buses, anything. It was just like eerily silent and quite beautiful in downtown, in the old part of Moscow. And the street ladies, the cleaners of the streets, every morning they washed the streets with hoses of water, and people scrubbed the streets with brooms. It was so clean and fresh. Prabhupada was remarking on that this was such a clean city, that this is a sign of good people at heart, that they keep their streets so clean. And other things he observed was, as we started across Red Square, he saw that Lenin's tomb. And people queued up at that tomb. This must be 5 in the morning, 5:30 in the morning, very early. People were queued up for several kilometers already to view the dead remains of the founder of communist philosophy. And we told Prabhupada that's what that was. He didn't know. He said, "What is that?" He said, "That is the tomb of Mr. Lenin." Oh, and then he would talk about, you know, obviously about how this society has been so misguided that they are worshiping the body of someone long departed from this body, who was basically a rascal and a devil. He said there were three men most responsible for all of the problems of the 20th century. Those three men were Marx and Lenin, Darwin, and Freud. Those three. He said they were the biggest rascals of all the philosophers of the 20th century and responsible for all of the problems. Darwin, Freud, made it a popular misunderstanding that the mind is a mechanical thing, that it's related, just like the body is related to cause and effect, and it's just a mechanical apparatus, the mind, and it can be controlled by artificial means through psychoanalysis. And the third member of that devil clan was Lenin and Marx. The same thing to him, to Prabhupada. Marx thought of the philosophy, and Lenin was the instrument of the philosophy. So He looked at that, and just before leaving India, in those days, people didn't have cameras, videos. There was no widespread communications around the planet. It took 1 month for an aerogram to go from Bombay to New York sometimes. Telephones were almost non-existent or very faulty. So it was difficult before I left Bombay, tried to find a camera. I thought I should record Prabhupada's visit in Russia with a camera, with some photos. But I wasn't an expert on cameras. I didn't know anything. And I had very little money. But I found in downtown Bombay, in the Fort District, in one of those little shops, I found one camera that I could afford. It was a little box camera made of, wood. About this big. It was a brownie camera. It just had one hole in it. One small hole and one button on top that you push. And the only film was black and white. They didn't have color film. And they had only one roll of this film, 12 shots, 12 films. So I bought it, and it was with us. And the first time I tried it was in the morning of that morning walk, first morning walk when Prabhupada walked through those streets in Red Square. And so I took a few photos. You know, one of the photos, you see his back going up this street into the sun, and it's quite a beautiful photo. And to get that photo, the right perspective, I had to lay down on my back in the street and shoot up like that. Prabhupada looked around after I took the picture. "What are you doing lying in the street? Get up." And that famous picture where he's walking across in front of the St. Peter's or whatever those cathedrals are, we kind of posed that. He started walking and I ran ahead of him and I got down again. I got down very low and I was pointing up. And the angle wasn't quite right. And I said, "Prabhupada, do you mind going back and then walking forward again?" "All right." And he did that, and he came back. As he came back forward, I snapped that famous shot of Srila Prabhupada. In fact, of all 12 of those pictures came out perfectly. I mean, they were just like prize-winning photos. Although I'd never used a camera in my life, it was Krishna's hand, another thing Krishna was doing. I didn't see the photos; they weren't developed for another month or so till we got back to the West. Anyway, so. Then those boys came back, and Prabhupada had invited them to come back the next day and to bring something to stay overnight. He said, "I only have 3 more days. I want you boys please to come and spend the night." The Indian boy, he said he couldn't do it. His home was at the embassy. He had to go back in the evening. But this Russian boy brought his clothing and actually slept on the floor by Prabhupada's bed. And for 3 days and 3 nights, Srila Prabhupada talked to this boy. After a while, the Indian boy wasn't that interested. Either he wasn't there or he sat on the side and listened. He thought, "I've already heard all of this. I know all of this." But the Russian boy was just like a sponge. He listened to everything Prabhupada said, and he repeated back. And Prabhupada taught him how to cook, went through all the procedures for cooking. He explained to him all the principles of vegetarianism, of Krishna conscious philosophy, chanting, the dress, the mannerisms, the culture, the tradition, the long tradition. Fortunately, we had that Bhagavad Gita. And Prabhupada was able to lead him through Bhagavad Gita. In 3 days, he taught him Bhagavad Gita. 3 days. And this boy was totally convinced. Totally convinced. I'd never had seen to that time, and I don't think subsequently I ever saw Srila Prabhupada so powerfully focused on one person. He was just like pouring Krishna consciousness into this boy. I had a desire, having read some books by, there were some famous authors in Russia at that time, one whose name was Solzhenitsyn, Alexander Solzhenitsyn. He had written some books that were very famous in the West. They were very controversial because they criticized the Soviet government, and yet he was a Russian citizen, so he was constantly being persecuted, this author, Solzhenitsyn. And I asked this boy, Anatoly, is it possible to meet this man, Solzhenitsyn, maybe even bring him here to Prabhupada, or Prabhupada can go to his place? And Anatoly says, well, let's try. So the next day he took me by subway and by bus far outside of Moscow, about maybe 50 kilometers. And I said, where are we going? He said, all of the artists in Russia, they are forced to live in one compound. All the dancers, writers, musicians, painters, everyone has to live in this one compound so that the state can keep their eye on them. A fenced compound. And he lives in there with the other artists. So I didn't know this at the time, but I found out later that I was forbidden to travel beyond the city limits of Moscow. If I would have been caught out there, they would have thrown me in jail as violation of my immigration visa. But it didn't. In those days, we didn't think anything. We took the biggest risks that we could, because we knew that Krishna was going to take care of us no matter what. We had Prabhupada's example in front of us. We had Krishna's example. Krishna was always the risky person in every situation. If the demon came, Krishna was the first one out to attack. And Prabhupada was like that. When the demon came, Prabhupada was the first one out there to attack. So he passed that spirit into us. So what if they try to throw me into prison? Krishna will protect me. I'll go. Let's go meet this Solzhenitsyn. But somehow or other, and everyone thought that I was from India because of the tilak and the dress. So I got away with a lot. If I would have been in Western dress, I couldn't have done any of this. So they led us into the compound, and we asked directions. We finally found Solzhenitsyn's house. And behind the house was a forest and a small cabin. And living with, because there were so many artists and so few homes, many of them lived in the same home. Living with Solzhenitsyn was a famous celloist named I can't remember his name. Anyway, a famous celloist played the cello, which is a bowed instrument, the best in the world, most famous in the world. And his wife, who was a famous ballerina, and as you know, the ballet of Moscow is the best in the world. So here were all these highly talented people forced into this compound. And they were very afraid. Very afraid of me. As soon as I started talking to them in American English, they were very, come over here. And we had to go behind trees to talk, and we were looking always for guards, because guards were patrolling the streets, soldiers. And they said that Solzhenitsyn was not there, that he was in jail. That the previous week he had been in that small cabin in the woods behind the house writing, and the KGB had come in and seized him and all of his writings and taken him to prison. So he wasn't available. And so I had one other small book that Malati had put in there called Easy Journey to Other Planets. I don't know if you've seen that book, but it was Prabhupada's first book, first small book. I mean, how bold do you get? Easy Journey to Other Planets. This was Prabhupada's first book. This was his style. So I gave that book to this lady, this famous ballerina, and her husband, and I said, well, when you get the chance, please give this to Mr. Solzhenitsyn. So then we left. And I found out years later, 25 years later, when I went back to Moscow, that he had read that book and was very impressed by it. And from reading that, all those people in that artist colony were favorable to Krishna consciousness. That book got passed around to every artist in the community. But we went back to Moscow, and Prabhupada finished his tutorship of this boy. And one day they forced us, as part of our visa arrangements, they forced us to go on a sightseeing tour of Moscow in a bus with other tourists, Japanese and other people on the bus. And we drove around. Prabhupada was so bored. He was sitting there going to sleep. Unless, if I saw something interesting, I would point it out. He would say, oh, okay, all right. The churches, again, I remember his comments on the churches as we passed them with the guards in front. You know, he was so struck by that, that these beautiful churches in Moscow, I mean, this marvels of architecture and beauty, were dilapidated and no one was going. And so many churches, so many. And so, but the, where they wanted to take us was to Stalin University. This was what they thought of as a tourist destination. Something all tourists would really want to see. So we went out to this university, which was huge. It was probably maybe 100,000 students, I don't know. But it was all these stark skyscraper-type buildings, just cement and glass and windows, one after the other for kilometers. And this was the guide, the tour guide was giving this wonderful lecture about how the advances of communism. Let's just see, we have so many nice universities. But Prabhupada was totally, totally unimpressed. In fact, out there, he said to me at the university, he says, Shyam Sundar, see if you can ask if we can leave. So I went over to the tour guide and I said, this man I am with is very old and he's quite ill right now. If we don't get him back to his bed, he may die. Even then she was reluctant, but finally she called a taxi and off we went. Phew, Prabhupada was so relieved to leave that sightseeing bus. And he came right back to life. You know, he was a pretty good actor. He was good. Just for the appeal, he kind of got like this and kind of gray in the face. And she's, oh, yes, okay, you can go. As soon as he gets in the car, it's back up, yakety, yakety, yak. And while we were going, the driver, he's Russian, of course. He doesn't speak only a few words of English. Maybe he's picked up from tourists or something. But somehow or other, Prabhupada was able to communicate with the guy. He talked to him about his children, his family. He wanted to know who Prabhupada was. And somehow or other, we were able to explain to this driver that Prabhupada was like a priest, a high priest in the Catholic Church, someone like a bishop. Very important man. So this driver, he became so happy that he had somebody, a spiritual holy man, in the back of his taxi. And when we got to the hotel, he wouldn't accept any payment. So, trying to think of other incidents. All this time I had to try to get food to supply us, which was very difficult. I remember one of Prabhupada's comments. Here it is, the most height of the growing season when everything should be flourishing and growing, and yet there's scarcity, there's shortage of food. This system is no good. Imagine in the winter, what will they eat in the winter? So I remember in one queue I stood in to get milk products, yogurt. We wound up eating mostly milk products because we knew that those were pure and they were more easily available. Milk, yogurt, cheese, things like that we were able to get. But Prabhupada wanted some rice one day. It took me half the day to find rice. And even then it was just a small bag of very tiny grains of rice from North Korea. And they were like rocks. Very bad rice. Anyway, so standing in this queue, this guy behind me kept tapping me on the shoulder. And finally I turned around and he whispered in my ear, he says, "Do you know yoga?" And I said, "Yes, we are yoga. We are bhakti yoga." And he said, "I can't talk with you here." But he said, I want to meet you. I want to find out about this yoga." And he was like this. And I was naive. I was a young Western naive boy. So I said, "Oh, sure, I'll come and meet you." And he gave me his address. And he said, "But you come at night. You come at 8 o'clock tonight." And you walk. And he gave me the directions to walk down this to his office in this building. And he said, "Look for the room with the light under the door. It will be the only room on that floor with the light on under the door. You'll see it. Come at 8, 9 o'clock. It was late at night. So I came back to Prabhupada, told him that this man had invited me to speak to him about yoga. It might be another opportunity to make a new devotee, a new friend here. And Prabhupada thought about it for one moment. And he said, "It is a trap. They are police. Do not go." So I didn't go. He knew everything, Prabhupada. Another incident happened while I was shopping for food. Someone told me there were some oranges available. No, cherries. Fresh cherries, you know, the fruit. Available in this one market. And they gave me walking directions. I went up there, and as I was walking there, suddenly there was a group of boys coming down the street, young men dressed in uniforms with red... No, they were dressed in working clothes, ordinary working clothes, but they all had red bands on their arms. And they came over, rushing over to me and threw me against the wall like that. And started, they were going to hit me and beat me up. And the guy just, and all the only word I could make out of it all, they were yelling at me, was "Document, document." And I went, "Oh, document, document, hotel, hotel." Ah, then they knew I was a tourist and they backed off. But I came to find out that these men were citizen police, that after work, they volunteered to patrol the streets of Moscow to look for deviations in the public behavior. Can you imagine? Police state. I told this to Prabhupada, and his impression was gradually growing of what Russia really was like. But he saw in the heart and soul of Anatoly and other simple Russian people that this was a good place for preaching. I couldn't understand why he wanted to be there. You can't do anything without getting thrown in jail there. So another thing that happened, I remember Aravinda, the cook, I was coming back from somewhere, walking up the stairs to our hotel room, and I saw Aravinda run out of this room and take a right and head down the hallway at a run. And then after him came this pot, cooking pot. It flew out the door and hit the wall on the other side. Boom! And Aravinda's running away, and he's running toward me. He says, "That lady wants to kill me." I said, "What happened?" And apparently it was the maid, one of the maids on the floor, and there was a little sugar in a container on the table, and Aravinda had used some of it for the sweet rice or something. And she caught him and wanted to kill him because sugar was so precious. They got it from Cuba. They trade missiles for sugar. Anyway. Yes, and then one of the days, I believe it was the last day or next to the last day, was a Sunday in Moscow. And the view from our window was out over the Red Square, you know, the Kremlin. And every Sunday, apparently, it was a tradition that the Red Army does a demonstration for the public, a public demonstration, a parade. And Prabhupada stood at the window from in the hotel room and watched this parade go by hour after hour. He just sat, remember what I was saying about how he would sometimes just quietly observe something, and you could tell that he was thinking all about Krishna. He sat and observed that parade for hours. Some rockets, I remember the rockets were so long, much longer than this building, and they had to carry them on four trucks, four lorries, under the one single rocket. And they would parade this by one after another, showing the people that how powerful the state was. And the soldiers were all marching. And when it was finished, Prabhupada turned around to us who were sitting in the room and he said, "You cannot rule a nation by fear. You cannot rule a nation by fear, by instilling fear in the people." He said, "At best, this government has another 20 years, then it's finished." 1971 to 1991, almost exactly 20 years. Prabhupada said it then. He knew. One of the arrangements that Prabhupada was making with this boy was how to carry on the Krishna consciousness. I had given him the Bhagavad Gita, and he said he had a way of reproducing it. Apparently they had some, in those days they had those old stencil machines, if you remember those, the mimeograph. You turn the handle and it makes copies. But first you have to type the stencil. So he said he had one a way of reproducing Bhagavad Gita, and he would do that and spread it around through his friends. I heard later that thousands and tens of thousands of that one Bhagavad Gita were made and distributed around the underground in Russia. So the arrangements that Prabhupada was making with this boy were longer term. The boy said, "You know, I can spread Krishna consciousness here if I'm married to a foreigner." Prabhupada said, "No problem." "We'll send you a wife." Okay. So that was one point. And then the boy said, "Also, I need books. I need literatures." Prabhupada says, "Okay." And he pointed to the Indian boy whose father was the ambassador to Russia. And he said, "It's your duty as an Indian citizen, it is your father's duty to bring books in through the diplomatic bags, through diplomatic ways, and give them to him." And he volunteered, he agreed to do that. He felt that it was his duty. And he said, "If there's any problem, you have your father come to me and I will tell him." He said, so the book thing was worked out. His marriage was worked out. He understood Krishna conscious philosophy completely. His food problem was solved. Every other aspect, every other problem he might have in spreading Krishna consciousness was answered and solved in 3 days' time. And then we left. And the plane was going from Moscow, it was going to Paris, to the ISKCON Center, the new ISKCON Center in Paris. So when we got to Paris, Prabhupada asked me, he says, "Is there a wife here for that boy?" And I knew one French girl because she had been living at the London Temple. So I said, "There's one girl here I think would be perfect for him. Her name is Mondakini, and I think she would be good." So he said, "Then call her here." So Mondakini came up and Prabhupada said, he was always so tactful, he says, "I would like you to marry." And she says, okay, Prabhupada. He says, "I want to send you to Russia to marry a Russian boy. Will you do it?" And she's a very shy and very, just such a nice devotee. And she said, "Whatever you say, Srila Prabhupada." So she agreed on the spot, sight unseen. I didn't have any photo of the boy. She didn't even know what he looked like. Neither did he know what she looked like. But she was a beautiful girl. He was very handsome. So after some time, she went to Russia and she married that boy. It didn't work out because of the difficulties of the immigration and the police, but she was able to help him for a long time in some ways. She got him books and so on, but the marriage never was successful, but it was a conduit to get information back and forth through the Iron Curtain. So we were like spies too. We were like master spies. We were more spies than the spies. We were infiltrating a whole new philosophy behind the Iron Curtain in the underground way, and changing the mindset of the country. I feel that Prabhupada had as much to do with the downfall of communism as anyone. There's no other explanation. Krishna consciousness was taking root. Automatically, the effect went out, and within a short time, the whole country fell apart. It was disintegrated, largely due to Prabhupada's work, his energy, 3 days of time. We can't even imagine the power of Srila Prabhupada's potency to do these things. I mean, he did it not only in Moscow, but all over the world. He came in to a group of maybe 100,000 or 200,000 hippies in San Francisco, the most degenerate lot of people in the planet, drugs and alcohol and unlimited free sex and sinful activity of every type. He came and sat down there, and within a short time he changed that whole situation. So, but Moscow is a very good example of Srila Prabhupada's energy and his power. Are there any questions anymore? Have any questions about something or points they'd like to hear about? We're supposed to stop now, right? Is it 9 o'clock? Excuse me? I didn't hear you. What?
We're in London.
London? Tomorrow? Okay, we'll talk about London tomorrow. Now, 25 years later, now it's more than that, but there was a 25th anniversary of Prabhupada's coming to Russia in 1996. And they invited me to come there. It was my first time back there since 71 with Prabhupada. 25 years later, I spoke in front of 10,000 devotees in Lenin Auditorium. were there chanting Hare Krishna in Lenin Auditorium. Just see. So when Prabhupada says Krishna consciousness can capture the world, it's a realistic assumption. It doesn't take very long. I heard so many stories when I was there of how those early devotees suffered. Oh my goodness, we have no idea. We could never do that. I could never do that. Being tortured by the police and thrown in jails and hospitals, psychiatric hospitals. The original boy, I met him again 25 years later, Anatoly. His name is Ananta, what is it? Ananta Shantidas. Yeah. He told me many stories that shortly after we left Moscow, he was thrown into prisons and into hospitals where they gave him massive electric shocks. electric shocks. They thought he was crazy. Anyone who talks about God is crazy. And as a result of that, he was not in a right mind. And 25 years later, he would be talking very fluently, and we would have him being having a nice discussion. Then all of a sudden, his mind would go somewhere else, and he would just start babbling nonsense. I felt so bad. This great hero of Krishna consciousness. Now his mind is not right. And other stories I heard, some of the early devotees were killed. There was one boy, apparently, who was very good at book distribution, and he was very bold, and he would not stand down if the police came. He continued selling books, passing out books in the public places of Moscow. So the police did not like him. Even in the bitter cold, in that country it gets very cold in the winters, even in bitter cold, the devotees would go out and distribute literature. They weren't allowed to have Sankirtan openly in any way, but they would distribute literature. And this boy, one day the police shot him, killed him with their rifles in the street in front of all the people. This killed him. He's distributing books. Another girl told me her experience. She was in all the women were taken to, and the reason they were put into labor camps and hospitals was because they would not divulge the names and whereabouts of the other Hare Krishnas. That was the whole point. They would catch one Hare Krishna and they would torture him and force him to try to give the names of the others and where they lived. And not one person broke under that. Not one devotee gave up his friends. They preferred the torture to that. Can we do that? I don't think I could do it. They would start torturing me and I'd say, oh yes, you want to go to so-and-so, so-and-so, I'd give them the whole list. I couldn't, I don't have that kind of strength. But these boys and girls, one girl, she told me she was put in a labor camp, very cold in Siberia, with only thin cotton clothes, all in the winter, dead of winter, they forced them to go out and work in the outdoors. And she was pregnant. And she was started to have her baby, so they allowed her to go in the room inside and have the baby. And 1 hour after having the baby, they made her get up and go back out and start working. So many stories I heard of the early sufferings of the Moscow devotees. So now what they're doing there is doubly wonderful in my eyes after seeing the history, how that all took place. And Prabhupada is doubly the hero for causing it to happen. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Jai. Jai.